Hi everyone, my name is Shona Lane. I'm Education Officer here at the Western Plains Cultural Centre.
Joining me today are Jess, our Collections Officer.
Hi.
Kent, our Curator.
Hi.
Caroline, our Assistant Curator.
Hello.
And Andrew, our Manager.
G'day.
Today we're turning our attention away from the gallery back to the museum, and in particular we're focusing on the role played by a museum. To commence this discussion, I'll start with the question, do museums tell the truth? Would someone like to take it up?
Whoa, what a question.
Is that the end? No, that's fair enough. Well, I'll start. I'm going to say, I suppose of all the modern institutions and all the modern things that we have, they're one of the few groups that actually attempt to actually tell the truth. Whether or not they succeed is another matter. You know, you can look at other institutions that used to try and tell the truth, like the media, you know, who used to, check up on the behaviour and the claims of political parties, now simply reprint their media releases and then make some sort of snide comment at the end on their own opinion. Mm. You know, so I think that whether or not they're succeeding, I think that they at least try.
I would agree with that. I think that certainly in the past there's been instances of institutions being raked over the coals for telling a particular truth, i.e. National Museum of Australia, Dawn Casey, the black armband view of Australian history. But I think a museum will always attempt to tell the truth and find truth in stories, in objects, etc. Whether or not it's agreed as the truth by the majority of people is sort of really conjecture. But I think it is. A museum definitely should aim towards telling the truth.
I think they should aim towards it, and I think the problem that we have kind of existing in, you know, the 21st century is that museums are interested in talking about truth, what is truth, whose truth is it, different perspectives on things, but I don't know that the museum going public has necessarily shifted with the museum industry as well, so that I don't know how many people go into a museum going, well, I'm aware that this is actually only one person or one group's in kind of opinion about the past. So I think there is a strange grey area that exists between what people expect of a museum and what museums expect of themselves. And in between you get this sort of half world where it's neither the truth, it's neither facts, it's neither opinion. It can slide into a generic kind of statement that doesn't address anything and is, you know, has no meaning for a lot of people.
Yeah. I'm slightly confused. What does the visitor, in terms of how the museum conducts its own business, how does the visitor's appreciation of that, how does that impact on what the museum is doing? So, for example, if we get away from the esoteric and we talk about, you know, the truth of, say, one of the immigration museums. They only tell a certain part of the story.
Yeah.
So I think that it's fairly unlikely that, say, the Immigration Museum down in Melbourne is going to tell of the fabulous crime gangs that existed within various immigrant groups within Australian history.
Mm. Why shouldn't it, though?
Well, but I don't think it's going to. But then does that negate its message?
Think it negates its message. No. What I mean is this idea that I think people still very much recognise museums as repositories of history, places where objects, facts are kind of stored. And I think there's an increasing trend within museums to be a lot more of a question rather than a statement. And I think people go into museums sometimes expecting a statement. So that's where I mean that the juncture exists between a public expectation of what a museum is for, what its role is, and what museums are increasingly seeing their role is, and they're kind of shifting between those two realities.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, you only need to look at the Australian War Memorial as an example of a museum that certainly has a very singular agenda in terms of what it is exploring, but by the same token, I definitely haven't seen shows come from the Australian War Memorial that deal with anti-war protests necessarily, which I think is just as important given that they explore every conceivable kind of effect that war has had on, you know, the home front, painters, you know, a whole host of different subject matter. So I think it's as much about the agendas that are set by institutions and museums, but also it's their ability to gain truth through research. I think human beings have proved to be both reliable and extremely unreliable when it comes to telling stories, passing down, you know, so-called facts, etc., from one generation to the next. So I think museums are always struggling with finding the truth amongst, you know, the mass of material that they are to go through to sort of tell the story. And I think that in an increasingly disparate world, in terms of the way that we communicate with each other, I think that's going to get even harder to find truth, where, you know, the emphasis is no longer on discussion between people. It's about texting, and you can't detect irony, you can't detect, you know, that's just an example. But then we all know that oral history is not exactly trustworthy either. So, yeah, I think it's...
But I think there's also, I mean, going a bit back to Andrew's point, that, and I don't know that museums can are about truth anymore. I don't know that truth is something sort of solid that you can grasp onto. But if people can't expect that of a museum, where can they expect it? Where can they go to for an objective look at history, society, culture, whatever? Where can you find that kind of foundation that then you can build your own opinions on?
But that sort of begs the question that those institutions have ever existed in reality.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we can say that some of the underpinnings, you know, so as museum professionals, when we put on shows and when others put on shows, in the background might be the fact that we are wanting people to ask questions.
Mm.
So if we look at your exhibition of On the Sly, there's questions underneath that about what sort of society Dubbo was, what sort of role women played in various levels of society and so on. But these are not out. You don't have those questions printed on the thing.
No.
So I think for many people, they go in there and what they see is that they see the fact of when Jean Lee was executed.
Yeah.
They see the fact of how many times Kate Lee went to prison. You know, they see the fact of the trial of, or the aborted trial or hearing of the alleged murderer of Ruby Green.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that, you know, have museums ever been in a position where they could really say, I mean, they may have claimed it, you know, this is the fact of our history, but have they ever been in a position where that is a tenable claim?
Well, I think definitely the, you know, what we're talking about is a sort of a pre-postmodernism and postmodernism argument that prior to postmodernism it was the history of the world. In post, it's a history of the world.
Mm.
We kind of realise that the canon, to go back to an earlier conversation, the canon, we couldn't place all of our trust and hope in a kind of a canon of works, that truth could be found in many, many different places, and that you could get an accumulative truth. It wouldn't just be all found in one source. I think the notion of truth is certainly part of an agenda. I don't know that audiences are necessarily asking for truth. I think they assume it's there.
Mm-hmm.
I think they go into a museum expecting to learn and assuming that what they learn is truth.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, you know, I found it interesting this week that there was talk about, yet again, about Hayden Fowler's video, and that, you know, one person had commented that one of the male figures was circumcised, and that, you know, another had commented that the female form was overweight, and that there's no way that could have happened back in primitive times. And that's an example of people looking for truth and fact in an artwork that isn't about that. So their search for, I think the audience's search for truth is sort of is always there, and in some respects is not delivered to the way that they require.
Or expect. Not that they require, because I don't know that they necessarily require the truthful facts about every single historical event that's ever happened, but they expect it. And so it's certainly, I don't know that museums are in a position to espouse truth, but we have to, in some way or form, understand that an audience is still expecting that part to play a role in the discussion.
Are we, in a sense, are we confusing two completely separate words? Are we looking at truth when we're really talking about fact? And I think museums, there is a fact. So there are facts such as,
the First World War started on this date.
Well, possibly. Maybe not the First World War. That might be a truth. But that, Archduke Ferdinand was shot on this day.
Yes.
And then there might be a truth that started the First World War.
Yeah.
And I think, going back to, the A history and so on, it was Manning Clark who wrote A History of Australia over many, many volumes. And it's an idiosyncratic and quite actually bizarre history. Beautiful to read, but he's at times over the top in the way that he approaches things. And, he was famous for saying, he responded to a critic who said, well, what do you say to people who say that your history is wrong? And he said, it's called A History of Australia. If you don't like mine, then write your own. And I think that's very similar. And I'm interested in what Shona might think as a most recently retired teacher. How does this play out in the schools? Where is that play between, history teaching students facts and getting them to maybe discover truth?
Oh, I think in the classroom it's particularly difficult because in a lot of cases it's about engagement, and I think that's a real issue for museums as well, that balance between telling a truth but also wanting to attract an audience that in a lot of cases, or in some cases, is coming to see a show almost to the point where they need to be entertained to bring them in, and that's very much the case in the classroom. You need to engage them, and if that, in doing that, and providing them with the facts often becomes really difficult because in a lot of cases the facts don't necessarily engage.
They're not exciting.
And so there's a potential
So what lies have you told your students to get them interested?
Syllabus documents. no, I promise I haven't told any lies, but there's definitely a need to not necessarily elaborate or embellish, but to make it engaging, whether it is through technology or, through role plays and things like that to try and get them to understand. And that, like I said, that's coming into museums as well in order to bring in an audience. There has to be some level of engagement, and if that means, adding something.
But also,
well,
I
think it comes down to agenda as well. And I think in an era when, a large museum such as the Powerhouse is putting ridiculous amounts of money into producing a show on the Wiggles, I don't think truth is even an issue to be talked about.
But I think...
Why?
Because I don't know what the purpose of looking for truth in the Wiggles is.
But the truth of what we enjoyed listening to.
Yeah, that's a blip on the radar.
But then, they've done... Then you would have to argue then against, everything that they've done recently. And again, then we're looking at what is truth in terms of what is important.
Is ABBA more important than the Wiggles?
Is who?
ABBA. More important than the Wiggles.
I don't know.
Depends on who you're speaking to, I suppose.
Wiggles are better dancers.
But I think, just going back to Shona's point, I think that idea of engagement is on a wider scale as well, that museums are increasingly aware of the fact that people learn, engage with the past in various different ways. So someone comes into a museum and they want to know what date Dubbo started, who started it, where they lived, what they did. The next person wants to come in and go, well, how do they feel about that? What was the experience like? Yeah. And you can't argue that one of those is truth and one of them isn't. So, again, I think it also comes back to the individual's experience of the museum and how they experience their world, and that's obviously how they're going to experience what truth is.
And the museum's role for presenting the intangible alongside the tangible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think you're right. I think that... audiences in some respect are less interested in the difference between fact and truth, that they assume that fact is truth, rightly or wrongly. And I think that a museum can only attempt to arrive at a truth of some kind, and that may be accumulative in the sense that the museum exhibit doesn't state the truth, but the material, you know, together as a whole can produce maybe that truth after the visitors left, or, you know.
Okay, we'll leave our discussion of the role of the museum there and move on to what's happening at the Cultural Centre. Kent, can you tell us what's happening in Kerrini?
At the moment we're installing Design Tech, which is an exhibition of HSC students who have done the design and technology subject at school. So it's a bit like Art Express, but for design and technology. And it will be quite remarkable in terms of the way that students have worked through an idea from, you know, idea through to a working prototype. So that'll be really interesting. And then in the project space, we have an exhibition called Brood, which looks at the permanent collection and is a celebration of the permanent collection as well as a celebration of the people who have contributed money over the years to allow us to acquire works for the collection. And so it looks predominantly at the, or completely at the animal in art theme. And it will be looking at that theme in another interesting way.
Okay, and I'm doing, I suppose, the more boring stuff. It's the end of the financial year, so looking at budgets. I know, you know, we're a business, in a sense, you know, we've got to pay the bills somehow. Also, in the next couple of weeks, our new program for the next 6 months, from July to December 2011, will be printed and available at the bargain price of Absolutely Free. So it'll be mailed out. So we're just sort of putting the finishing touches to that. So I'm sort of heavily engaged in that sort of backroom shenanigans.
I've finished up with Box of Tricks and artwork for this term, so that'll be happening again in August and September, and currently getting together some education resources for Design Tech and Art Express. So teachers, if you're listening, bring your students in to see two fantastic school-related exhibitions. And moving on to what's happening elsewhere, the Today Show on Tuesday morning ran a story on Alita Andre. She's a four-year-old Australian artist who is currently exhibiting her work in a New York gallery solo exhibition. Her highest selling painting has been $25,000, and her paintings are normally priced between $5,000 and $10,000. So I thought I'd put that up for discussion. Anyone want to go first?
What a chip. Can I just point out that there are lots of child prodigies in the world? Mm-hmm. Like, what's Tiger Woods? Wasn't he a child prodigy golfer?
Yeah.
But if you'd put him on the back tees at St Andrews when he was 7 years old, he wouldn't have reached the women's tee with his first shot. So there's some sort of I suppose there's a measured objective, and there are, you know, gifted child athletes and all the rest of it, but they don't measure up to the I suppose the adult standard.
They're not at the Olympics, you know.
They're not at the Olympics.
Yeah.
There's not
Usain Bolt's not lining up against a 4-year-old. Yeah.
Although they've got those little legs, can pump at a 4-year-old. I think maybe it gets down to, I suppose, that age-old thing that, you know, what is the measurement? And, you know, the value of art is if somebody is prepared to pay $25,000 for something that a 4-year-old allegedly did, then away you go.
I think it's interesting that this has happened in the States. I don't see it as a distinctly Australian thing to sort of raise children up to levels that they can't quite reach. I think that's a very American thing to do.
You're very proud of your daughter's work?
Extremely proud of my children's work. But, you know, I wouldn't want to put the pressure on her to perform as an artist in the same way that, you know, I wouldn't have ever wanted her to have been photographed by Anne Geddes. I think that certainly four-year-olds produce extremely beautiful drawings and paintings. I think children's art, as a general rule, is extremely moving and touching for those that, particularly the people who are related to the child. But I would also say that they are extremely pure expressions. I think they're the closest that we get to cave paintings in the sense that they're making a mark, they're expressing the world around them. And I think in some respects they are before they have been indoctrinated by, you know, the rest of the world. They've certainly started to be indoctrinated, but they're a lot more purer. So, you know, art as it is, being the big subjective thing that it is, you know, you can either say that it's worth $25,000 or you don't.
It's worth nothing.
Do you think it has implications for those, for the general public out there who already have opinions about the art world?
I think they just laugh at it.
No. I actually think it is, I mean, for much of what how I understand it, it's kind of marketing plays a very big role in why these things get on the television, that they're a kind of interesting news story. And I think they fit into that prejudice against particularly contemporary art of, my kid could do that. Here's a news story that shows you a kid is doing it, they're selling. So I think it's fitting into an established idea about art anyway. So I don't know that it's actually clouding people's opinions about art. I think it's giving it legitimacy kind of thing.
Well, I think also, I mean, you know, when the news tends to cover any story related to the art world, it's because some freakish thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's either because it's some outrageous artwork that, you know, the media has deemed to be inappropriate, or, you know, it's some freakish instance of a four-year-old, you know, painting. I think the PR people for that four-year-old have worked pretty hard and have had quite a successful run of things. But essentially it's taken that out of the context of maybe what it is. I mean,
but these sort of stories about a child prodigy in terms of art come up every couple of years. And there's a new story about a six-year-old being discovered who's the new Picasso. And it's a new story for a little while, but then you never hear about them having another show when they're 10 or 12 or 15. So there isn't the sense of it being a career that starts and then you see them blossom into a really successful, mature artist. But I think from my point of view, there's an element of consciousness that goes into the creation of an artwork that I don't know is necessarily there in child art, that an awareness of why I'm making it, who's it for, what it means, what it's about, that makes something an artwork that I don't know that necessarily, you know, children are putting into the work that they're making. They're enjoying it. They're having fun with colour, they're having fun with shape, they're learning about the world, but I don't know that they're consciously going, this is an artwork that I want people to learn about X, Y, Z.
No, they're certainly not saying, I want a, you know, beige mat on that with a nice frame and some glazing.
No.
I mean, they're quite happy to just throw it in the box with the rest of the drawings and forget about it.
Exactly. And I think the comparisons of particularly this young artist who's been made to Jackson Pollock is really, you know, very simplistic and says it's actually what it's doing is reducing the work of Jackson Pollock. It's not elevating her work up to a masterpiece, because Jackson Pollock's work is all about getting in touch with the subconscious, and it's a real psychoanalytical process that he's going through. And I don't know that a four-year-old's doing that. So,
okay, we'll leave our discussion there. If you'd like to make any comments or have any questions, you can post something on Facebook or go to our website.
pccdubbo.org.au.
We're a professional team.
But we would like to know that at least one person listens to this, so if you're that one person, please just send us an email and say, yep, I've listened.
And you've made it.